everyone, and welcome to a brand new episode of the Cinephiles Live here on the Cinephiles YouTube channel. I am one half of the Cinephiles. I'm John Rocha, joined as always by my better half here on the show, stunning Steve Morris. Steve, how are you today?
Well, I will accept stunning, but I will not accept better half. This is an equal partnership, sir. But yes, you're right. I am stunning. I'm recently back from New Zealand where I got a bunch of sun. My skin is like more like a healthy color. I feel very good. How are you? You also look stunning, by the way.
Well, thank you very much. Very kind of you. It's the new glasses, I think, probably. But it's also the extra lighting that's washing away the wrinkles today. But we are here live. And listen, we're here live for, you know, a reason that we're not very happy about. But we have decided to do something really unusual, as Steve and I have spoken about on the live, on our previous meetings with the advisory board and also on social media and on our previous shows, that we are going into a season of Rob Reiner. Now, those of you who watch our show or listen to our show, you know that our seasons have been starting a little later because we want to kind of ramp up into it. But this year, we are going to do two seasons of a director, and it is because of the passing of Rob Reiner. Steve, it's really kind of crazy for me to think about. It's already been a month since he passed away. Sadly, him and his wife, of course, in a brutal murder. And of course, we're not going to get into the specifics or who's to blame or anything like that. This is more a conversation about the man's life, his career, and his legacy. And for those of you who've done or who've listened to our seasons of before, you know, we usually like to start out with a kind of biography and conversation about the person that we're profiling, the director we're profiling for these seasons. So, Steve, what's your feelings walking into this season of Rob Reiner that is so unusual from any season we've tackled in the past?
Well, it's really his death. I mean, it was so sad. It was such a, you know, when we've done this before, we did directors who had, you know, classic directors like Orson Welles, Hitchcock, Kurosawa, and then we've done directors like Coppola. You know, we did the Coen brothers. We did a whole bunch of other ones, but we didn't do them for this reason. Yeah, right. We didn't do them for, oh, we've just lost this person. And we also, you know, in the past, when we've lost a famous actor or a director, we certainly did a tribute and we would maybe pick a movie of theirs to do. But this is different. And I think it's different for a bunch of reasons. One is just to be honest, I think I might have said this when we did our initial tribute, but there are only a few deaths in the entertainment world that have hit me as hard as Rob Reiner. One of them was Robin Williams and one of them was Phil Hartman. And in both of those cases, they were people I truly loved. Like it's funny when you think about it, is that there's certain artists who you go like, wow, that guy's a great artist. I think Meryl Streep is amazing. I think Daniel Day-Lewis, a fantastic actor. I think De Niro's a great actor. I think Aaron Sorkin is an amazing writer. Yes. They don't feel like part of my family. You know what I mean? Robin Williams was part of my life.
Right.
You know, Phil Hartman, particularly that era of news radio and The Simpsons right after Saturday Night Live, it's like I felt a connection to that person. And man, Rob Reiner, that is true in spades. And it is funny because you've made this joke before and I'm sitting here, I have his Wikipedia page up and a smiling picture of Rob Reiner is looking at me. And I'm like, man, I do look like Rob Reiner. it's really weird. His whole style of directing, his way of approaching films, there's so much about him that I relate to this person. And so I think that's what makes this different. Yes, every year we do a season or director. This year, we're going to do two. We'll go into details on that a little bit later. But like this person is, I feel like I've lost part of my family. And these movies, his films are part of my family too.
I think that's we did a tribute to him a few weeks ago. And this is a different approach to it. But I just remember that I was in so many different places about it because of the manner in which he passed. But then looking back on these movies and feeling guilty, to be honest, that I hadn't like given them the extra respect and recognition they deserved, because sometimes, you know, we get caught up with like, well, these are the classics. These are the epics. These are the ones that we need to revere. And sometimes certain directors who make really moving, touching, influential films that cross across multiple age brackets and become mainstream, we can sometimes dismiss them a little bit as more populist entertainment or what have you. And we wait for that with Spielberg, like we wait for that Schindler's List. Yeah, all that other stuff is great. Jaws is fun. Close Encounters is fun. But we wait for that Schindler's List to really show us what he can do. But with Rob Reiner, we didn't need that, right? And I think I felt guilty that I hadn't respected his films quite as much as I should have. And I was more caught up in the joy they brought me, the nostalgia they brought me, the feelings I had when I watched these movies when I was younger, and the joy I get out of the quotableness of all those movies. And I think that got in the way of me really appreciating him as a director and these movies as really well-constructed films. And to be honest, even the ones we've done on the show, which we've done a number of Rob Reiner, he might be our most done director. I don't know, Steve. I haven't done the numbers, but we might have done the more films from Rob Reiner than maybe any other director. And so that made me feel even more guilty that I hadn't given these things more respect than they had reserved in my mind. But getting ready for the show today, I certainly had to sit back and go, my God, what an amazing career. What an amazing voice he had as a director with all these different types of movies. And a very consistent, solid voice throughout, you know?
I think there's signposts of what we're supposed to, you know, laud on an artistic level. Like this is the artsy things. And when you become a cinephile, and I think this is something you and I have been fighting against since the beginning of the show, really, which is that we never, you know, I'm not going to name names, but there's certain critics out there who are very hoity-toity and intellectual, and that they're always like, I need to be the smartest, pick the most unusual, let's look into this Buñuel, Kubrick, whatever, you know, whatever it is. And
that stuff's
great. I have no objections to that. I love those films too. But it comes with a sort of poo-pooing of horror movies and action movies and kung fu films and dumb comedies and comedies. Like that. Yeah. And it's like, no, these are all great movies. It's like, when I was, you were in a theater program. I was in a theater program acting. And at least at Cal was a super intellectual place, UC Berkeley. Their theater program was all about PhDs looking for, you know, some, you know, biomechanical artsy fartsy thing. And that's what it was like. Nobody at Cal would ever have done a Neil Simon play. Because Neil Simon was looked down as like, well, that's just for the people. That's just comedy. That's just light stuff. And I'm like, no, Neil Simon is one of the greatest playwrights in the history of playwriting. And it's all the intellectuals that poo-pooed him that didn't understand the true genius. And that's how I feel about Rob Reiner, is that it's like, Rob Reiner is not trying to make movies like Stanley Kubrick or Martin Scorsese or Quentin Tarantino or Spike Lee. He's not making those kinds of films. He is making very accessible, wide audience, a beautiful light touch. And I wish we could interview Martin Scorsese because he was buddies with Reiner. Right. And I wish we could hear him talk about Reiner's movies, because my guess is he would go, I could never make The Princess Bride. I could never make One Harry Met Sally. He can't do that. Like he can do what he can do. And it was interesting. I listened to because we're obviously in the middle of When Harry Met Sally right now. Mm-hmm. That is one of the films we're going to be doing. And one of the things that Rob Reiner said is, I never want the camera to take away from the story. The camera is there to photograph the story. It is not to show off. Mm. And there are a lot of directors who are showing off with the camera. No disrespect to that. But Reiner is going, this is what I'm doing. This is the story. It comes first. And what he's doing is like a high wire act. It's so hard.
I think that's what, you know, as I've watched tributes and read more stuff on him over the last month, as we've said, since we've lost him, I've come around on like, there's something you just said that kind of struck an idea I'd had a couple of weeks ago about him, is that he's a writer's director. And I think what you just said, like the camera is not in, it doesn't want the camera to get in the way of the story. To him, the story is the important thing. And so there's many ways to direct a movie. Steve, you as a director obviously know that. There's many ways to direct a movie where it becomes avant-garde, like that Macbeth film that we just had with Denzel, that's very German neo-expressionism and all of that, and the way it's shot, black and white, 4x3, and angles, and Dutch angles, all those kind of things. And so that's an approach that's stylistic while still honoring the text, right?
Right.
But the way Rob Reiner does things, it's much more about the story, the characters, the relationships. Yes, are there some really fantastic shots and how he's framing certain shots for maximum emotional effect or impact? Absolutely. But you're not walking out of a Rob Reiner film and going like, oh, the cinematography. It was about the story and about what's going on and the lessons And the messages, I know that's a dirty word nowadays, but messages that he wants you to take away from his movies that I would argue, Steve, are no less powerful than some of these more avant-garde, as you said, more toity-toity type of movies that we've seen in the past to deliver messages that are very, very similar to what Rob Reiner is doing. He's just making them more consumable for more people. And I think that's takes a certain amount of artistry as well, you know?
I mean, I think about, you know, it's funny, you've asked me more questions about editing lately. And one of the things I've been thinking, When Harry Met Sally, we'll talk about it, is that one of the things about editing, I can tell you in When Harry Met Sally, I believe pretty much why every single shot is in the movie, what purpose every single shot serves in terms of storytelling, why you needed to cut to see Sally's reaction at this moment, what specifically that reaction was telling us, why we had to have this insert, why we had every single shot is there for a reason. That is exactly the same amount of craftsmanship and attention to detail that we love in all the other movies that we love. It's just, it's as you said, it's in a consumable way. And, you know, you say that these films mean something. I mean, there are few films that were more impactful than When Harry Met Sally at that time for those people. And it's like, yes, everybody reposts. My son has probably seen the Jack Nicholson, "You Can't Handle the Truth" meme over and over and over again. But in fact, that movie, which is another film we're going to break down for A Few Good Men, has a ton to say and is very, very topical right now in terms of the legal system and where we sacrifice ends in favor of means or means in favor of ends. It definitely has something to say.
I agree. And and especially as a guy who was in the military, what rules you are supposed to follow and not follow, what orders you should adhere to, what orders you shouldn't adhere to. So absolutely. All those years later, here's a film that still can resonate with what we're going through in our world. And I think that's another thing that's really a fantastic element of his film, Steve, is that they're very universal. They're evergreen, for lack of a better term. We've all grown up as young kids, had those young friends, gone on those adventures with our young friends. Yeah, maybe it's not a dead body, but it's something that we experienced either together on an adventure or separately and then talked about it later as we're growing up, you know, like group of friends. And then we grow away from those group of friends. That happens as well with you see in Stand By Me, right? Or we have, as you said, the relationships when Harry Met Sally. What are the seminal relationships that change us? And what are the relationships that we end up settling down with and really finding true love with, which a lot of people don't do. And you see that in the movie here, the way it's highlighted is fantastic. And then you go into something like Misery, which is about, you know, a very powerful commentary on fandom. And that's something that certainly, Steve, is very topical nowadays, more so than even in the early 90s when Misery came out. This idea of toxic fandom, this idea of fans feeling like they're owed things from the creators, like the people they grew up. You and I just finished watching Pluribus. There are elements of that in Pluribus that echo what we see in Misery. And of course, it's based on Stephen King's book, but Rob Reiner bringing that out so powerfully in his direction of that movie is amazing. And then you move to American President, which is probably his most mature work that I think is fantastic in how it explores the presidency, what the presidency is supposed to mean, and the things that he confronts as the president, trying to implement the things that he wants to implement and the place he's coming from to try to do what's great in the world versus people who are trying to satisfy their own personal impulses or desires in political power. So it's just a fascinating thing when you explore his movies and the range of these movies and what they're trying to say to our world and still say and echo in our world nowadays.
I absolutely couldn't agree. Hi, this is Steve. Almost every family deals with it at one time or another. That moment when you realize that the challenges you face are far more than you can handle and you need help. For my family, that moment came in the fall of 2008 when my dad was diagnosed with the neurodegenerative disease, ALS. My family needed help. Fortunately, we found incredible caregivers with the skills, patience, and most importantly, compassion to help us through this incredibly difficult time. We were lucky to find the right people at the moment we needed them most.
But finding great caregivers isn't easy, and that's where Care.com comes in. There, you'll find safety and hiring tools so you can search for your exact need, whether it's meal prep and companionship, transportation, or even taking that new puppy for a walk. Care.com has you covered. You can even get a senior care advisor plan and talk to a master's-level social worker to build a personalized care plan. The Cinephiles is partnering with Care.com because we believe it's an easier way to find help. For a limited time, go to Care.com and use code Cinephiles for 20% off your initial Care.com subscription or a senior care advisor plan. That's C-I-N-E-F-I-L-E-S, all one word. With Care.com, start your senior care journey with confidence. When it's not you, it's Care.com.
Let's do a little bit of a biography of him.
Yes, please.
So Rob Reiner was born in 1947 in the Bronx. And here's the thing about him I've been thinking a lot, which is his father, obviously Carl Reiner, his mother Estelle Reiner, both actors. Carl Reiner, a hugely important figure in comedy in the 50s and 60s. Right. But I actually think it's between 47 and I think it's 55 is when your show of shows starts. So your Sid Caesar's Your Show of Shows.
Yeah.
It's one of the most influential comedy shows of all time. There's the big shows at that time were Uncle Milty and what's the I forget the name of the other comedian who did more surreal stuff, just went out of my brain. But regardless, the biggest one is Sid Caesar's Show of Shows, where I think they were doing two shows a week of an hour and a half of material live.
Wow.
Which is, so it's a double Saturday Night Live. Yeah. And Carl Reiner comes on as sort of a writer and also the right-hand man for Sid Caesar. But I actually think from 47 to 55, those 8 years that he's living in the Bronx, as just a kid growing up in the Bronx, is hugely influential. Because one of the things about Rob Reiner, even though I know that he lived in Los Angeles for much of his life, he's a New Yorker. That old school New York Jew who loves the Yankees and all of those things, that is so specific to him. And I think, you know, there've been discussions about Nepo babies and when is that okay and when is that not okay? And like, do I think there are times when someone who is related to someone else gets an extra step up? Absolutely. That happens. Right. And that isn't always fair, but there's also something about growing up in the world.
Yeah.
And understanding that world from the inside and the way he grew up, first in New York. They're living, by the way, it always cracks me up because they lived in New Rochelle. And New Rochelle, of course, is where Dick Van Dyke and Mary Tyler Moore lived in the Dick Van Dyke Show, because they're playing a version of Carl Reiner and his family. And so that's where they came up. And at the time he's coming up, he's going to your show of shows. And I know we've brought it up before, but we should bring it up again, because your show of shows is the greatest writing room in the history of comedy. Here is who is in. We already mentioned one of them. Well, we mentioned two. We mentioned Carl Reiner, of course, one of the great directors and writers. Neil Simon, one of the great playwrights, gets his start on your show of shows. His older brother, I think it's Sam Simon, is on the show. And then you have Larry Gelbart, who wrote Oh God, the creator of MASH, who wrote Tootsie, one of the great comedy writers of all time. And Mel Brooks, of course, one of the great comedians, one of the funniest people in history. And there's a whole bunch of other heavy hitters that are on this. I think Mel Tolkien is the name of the head writer at the time. I mean, this, and then near the end of the show, they bring in a young writer who had been writing jokes and getting along. And that, of course, is Woody Allen. Like, this is the, you know, the Slugger's Row. This is like Murderer's Row of comedy writers. And that is the world that Carl Reiner is in. And people like Norman Lear are in this orbit at the same time. And so little Rob Reiner, 7, 8, 9, 10, 11, 12 years old, is coming onto this set to hang out with these comedy gods.
Right. Yeah. And also his, I mean, he comes from a very talented family, as you said about his parents, but his, what is his, Annie Reiner, his sister, is a poet, a playwright, and an author. His brother Lucas is a painter, actor, and director. So you have, you know, like a lot of talented people that are around this. This is just one of those families, Steve. We know this as we study people in life. They're just those families that I just go into the family business in a lot of ways, whether it's performing or politics or business. They just go into that and understand it because they're naturally gifted to go in that direction, Rob being one of them. But I imagine growing up at that time, like, that's such a perfect time to grow up in this country, right as the Yankees are coming on. He talks about going to see Mickey Mantle in Yankee Stadium, and just young kid in the Bronx, and all the electricity and energy and artistry of New York being right there. And as you said, his access to these incredibly talented people who are at the top of their game. You know, your show is essentially SNL in a higher level back then, and what they were able to create and going live and what have you. So there's all, so if he had no interest in it, I don't think he would have pursued it. But clearly, you know this, Steve, sometimes you're just born with that bug and you get bit. And when you get bit, that's it. And clearly Rob Reiner from the beginning was someone who wanted to be a part of this world and be in this world, because this is his path. And he just goes almost immediately into it. As he's getting older, goes into the studying, goes into going to getting onto a show, all these kinds of things. Clearly, this was something that he absolutely loved doing, being a creative artist.
Absolutely. And I just have to share a couple of other stories because I have some good. So first of all, can I tell you my favorite show stories? Not directly related to Rob Reiner, but I was watching, there was like a reunion of all the writers and actors, and Sid Caesar was there, and Imogene Coco, and all these people were there. It was a reunion panel. I think I told this story years ago on the Cinephiles, but at one point, someone asks, I think they asked Carl Reiner, someone says something about, this is funny and this is witty. And the moderator says, well, what's the difference between funny and witty? And Carl Reiner says, well, I mean, the difference, we actually had the funniest person, we had the wittiest person in the world in the person of Larry Gelbart, and the funniest person in the world I blow the story a little bit, and the funniest person in the world in the version of Mel Brooks. And the moderator says, well, what's the difference between funny and witty? And as he's asking this question, Mel is smartly drinking out of a bottle of water. And as the minute you hear, what's the difference between funny and witty, the words are like hanging there. Yeah. And Mel does a huge spit take, boom, spit take everywhere. And then there's a pause. And then Larry Gelbart, with the slow turn, looks over at the moderator and says, wit is dry. And I'm just like, that is perfect. So that's what Rob Reiner grows up with. And then, of course, in the early 60s, now Rob is a teen, Carl Reiner does what is arguably one of the greatest sitcoms of all time. And I think young people, you know, you always talk about people not watching the old black and white movies, not watching the old stuff. You need to, if you're a comedy person, you need to go back and watch the original Dick Van Dyke Show. Because the Dick Van Dyke Show, I mean, it has some of the greatest, funniest episodes ever made. And that is A, based on Carl Reiner, Rob's dad's life, you know, and B, Rob is there on the set, 13-year-old boy or whatever he is at the time, 14. And at one point, I'm just going to tell the story because I heard both Carl Reiner and Rob Reiner tell this story, which is, and you're going to take it, look, I'm not condoning what happened in this story. I'm just going to tell it to you. But apparently, Mary Tyler Moore, who is the co-star with Dick Van Dyke, comes storming into the office, very upset, and tells Carl that Rob Reiner, his 14-year-old son, grabbed her ass.
Oh, no.
Yes. Oh, yes. And so she is very upset. She feels that was inappropriate.
Yeah.
And Carl calls his son in. Did you do this? Yes, I did this. Please apologize to Mary. That is totally inappropriate. I cannot believe that you did that. And Rob does so, apologizes, and Mary goes, okay, it's no big deal. Thank you for the apology. I appreciate it. She goes back to work. And now alone in the room, Carl turns to his son and says, what was it like? And Rob said, fantastic. And then they talked about the capri pants that that Mary Tyler Moore would wear on the show. Again, I'm not condoning the story.
Of course.
I'm merely giving some context to how Rob came up. One other thing about this is Rob wanted to be an actor and wanted to do comedy. But the one person who didn't think he was funny was his dad, Carl Reiner. He just didn't think he was funny.
Wow. Yep. Isn't that crazy? Family, man. Family. It's just that way. And I think that is sometimes the case when you know someone so well. You can't objectively step outside and see what it's like to be someone who doesn't know them that well, who doesn't see all their tics and their tells and all of these things where you can dissect the comedy, especially someone like Carl, who clearly is an incredibly intelligent and a funny comedian and knows his business really well. I'm sure he could tell everything his son was doing before his son did it. And so it would remove the ability of the surprise element of comedy that is such a massive part of comedy. Whereas other people who didn't know Rob that well could see that. And I'm glad Rob wasn't caught up in trying to please his father or trying to accept his father's advice and not go into it. You know,
right.
He clearly endured and kept going. And thank God he did, because we've seen some really interesting performances from him. I watched a little bit of Wolf of Wall Street the other night, seeing how funny and great he is in that. And then, of course, what he becomes as a director. But you're right. So, go ahead, Steve.
No, I got a couple more stories that sure. I just to get him in. Then so part two of this is he goes to high school, Beverly Hills High School. So this is all the Children of the Stars with all these famous people, including Richard Dreyfuss is there. And of course, Albert Brooks is in high school with him, also a neighbor. And while Carl didn't think that his son was funny, everybody thought Albert Brooks was funny. And I know you've watched the great documentary that that Rob did on Albert, but they're like literally Albert would do bits and have Mel Brooks and Sid Caesar and Carl Reiner, the professional funny people. This high school kid would have him rolling in the aisles. And apparently Mel Brooks went on the Johnny Carson show and said, the funniest person I know is a 16-year-old named Albert Brooks. So I don't know how that feels for Rob Reiner, but then what finally happens is that Norman Lear is casting All in the Family and decides to cast Rob Reiner and goes to Carl because they're buddies because they all came up together and says, I'm going to cast your son in this role. And Carl said, but he's not funny. And then it was finally Norman Lear professionally saying that it was funny that let Carl actually look at his own son and realize that he was funny and did have talent.
And he built to it. I mean, I think we should be fair to him as we talk about Nepo Baby. It wasn't like they handed them this. Rob Reiner built through this in the 1960s. His first role was at 14 years old on a series called Manhunt. Then he's in Batman, the series Batman. This is all the 1960s. He's in That Girl, The Andy Griffith Show, Room 222, Gomer Pyle, one of my favorites growing up as a kid, the Beverly Hills Hillbillies, another favorite of mine as a kid. And then he gets into an improv group there in San Francisco in 1969 with Larry Bishop. He begins writing for the Smothers Brothers Comedy Hour in 1968 and 1969, working alongside Steve Martin and Carl Gottlieb of Jaws fame there, Steve. He ends up directing a one-act play at the Oxford Theater in L.A., and then gets involved in other films like Where's Papa? He's in Hell Halls of Anger with Jeff Bridges. He's in a film called Headmaster with Andy Griffith. And then goes and does The Super. And then eventually, as we said, gets into the 70s there with All in the Family. So he built he did his time in the smaller shows, getting those parts, doing the day player stuff or doing the recurring character, getting some film roles. So he working on his craft. And I think the thing is, when you believe in yourself, and it always seemed to me that Rob Reiner had that energy, that he just believed in himself simply to do the things that he was doing. You don't have to be loved by the great comedians at the time, right? Albert Brooks appealed to them because Albert is Albert and he has a very distinct, unique sense of humor. I think Rob is much more of the people pleaser, much more of the mainstream humor. And maybe some of these comedians didn't appreciate that, even though they themselves have written some mainstream stuff like Dick Van Dyke. So whatever the reasons were that he didn't get across at the same level as Albert Brooks, the fact that he kept going, I think, deserves a lot of credit, because a lot of artists stop going forward because enough people tell them that they don't think they're good at what they're doing or they don't think they're funny. And so thank God he kept going and then built his resume to get to where you just pointed out there in the 1970s, to get on All in the Family and get really well known, you know? And arguably, I think, before Albert Brooks got well known, Steve, I think.
It seems it's a great question. It's certainly right around the same time. Maybe it is a little bit earlier. I think you might be right. Yeah. The couple of things. First of all, if you are interested in the Smothers Brothers Comedy Hour, there's a book called Dangerously Funny, which is all because this is again, just as the Dick Van Dyke Show is extremely important in terms of comedy.
Yeah.
The Smothers Brothers, incredibly important. And this was the most controversial show of the late 60s, censored multiple times. Like people were trying to get it off the air. If you look again at things going on today with a president hating what is happening on a certain comedy show at a certain network and pressuring people to get that taken off the air, that is the Smothers Brothers Comedy Hour. And Rob Reiner is right in the middle of it. I also think in terms of him as an actor, and I think he is a good actor.
I do.
But I have a theory, and my theory is probably not true, but I'm going to tell you anyway, which is there are certain actors who I watch and I kind of feel like I can see them directing themselves, where you can kind of go like, this is like the big perfect example of this is Jonathan Frakes on Star Trek The Next Generation, where the character of Riker, he's always making the right choice. You know, like he is a good, solid actor, but it's that thing. This is how I imagine that I look like when I'm acting, which is understanding what is required and what is supposed to do, but not the most in the moment excitable actor in the world. I think Rob Reiner and everything he's ever done delivers what is needed, but I don't think of him as a magical actor. I think All in the Family is where he's absolutely the best. And we should talk a little bit about that show. I mean, it's an amazing show, but I actually think that he needed to be a director. That is where he's supposed to be. That's where his talent is. As far as All in the Family is concerned, it is crazy to me that that show exists. It is crazy to me the courage of Norman Lear to make it, the courage of all the actors that are on it, because they all are willing to look ridiculous, willing to say things that people are going to hate, and willing to jump into topics that everybody is afraid of talking about. And man, we could use things like All in the Family today. That's what I think.
Yeah, I think, you know, Roseanne was kind of like that for a lot of people as well, reflecting the uncomfortable conversations. I think everybody on All in the Family was a much better actor than Roseanne Barr, but Roseanne, the actors around Roseanne were really a big reason why that show was successful. Just like Seinfeld, the other three actors are the ones who are really outshining Jerry the whole time, but it is about the conversations they're having on that show. They are not afraid to tackle. I mean, people think that all these topics all of a sudden showed up like 5 minutes ago here in our society, but All in the Family tackles everything: racism, abortion, killing of gay people. Like, there is so much that they tackle on that show throughout. And they were the top rated show for 5 seasons, top most watched television program in the United States for 5 consecutive seasons from 71 to 76. So, clearly reflecting the society. And I do believe, Steve, we haven't changed as a society. I think we got scared and we went one way to the, swung the pendulum one way, and now we're trying to swing the pendulum the other way. But the truth is, most of America always sits right in the middle. We're not afraid to talk about these uncomfortable subjects, but we also want to be able to talk about these uncomfortable subjects without people jumping down our throats and play with the comedy of it all. And I agree with you. We need a show like All in the Family again to come back and kind of get us to understand that it's not that serious, and yet it is kind of serious. So just be aware of how to deal with that. And if you watch those shows, I've watched some clips of those shows recently, and the writing is still tight. The performances are great, and it's very touching and very moving, you know. And Sally Struthers, Carol O'Connor, Gene Stapleton, and Rob Reiner all have fantastic chemistry throughout. It launched The Jeffersons. I think it launched Maude. So it is
Good Times.
Good Times, right. Yeah, it is a show that launched so many different shows out of that. And I think they tried, they spun off Archie, I think, after she died, because he wanted to go forward with it, but it didn't quite work. But like, there's so much that happens. And he's such a great addition to the show. He's not the best actor on the show, as you said,
right?
But he works representing it's almost similar to One Battle After Another. He represents the like goofy liberal who's stumbling over himself, right, to try to do things right. Exactly.
Well, this is what's so great, is that he is giving voice to what I think are closer to the beliefs of Norman Lear and the writers and the creators of the show than anybody else. But he's often a fool, you know, and he says dumb things, and he is some of the criticisms that Archie has of Meathead are true about lazy or unrealistic or all this stuff. And then Archie is saying things, I mean, some of the most horrible, ignorant, stupid things. And it is designed to be that way. It is designed. Yeah. And yet it is also things that people believe. And some of the things he says, you're kind of like, wait, maybe do I agree with Archie? And that makes you feel really weird. And the whole thing is that this amazing about the show is that you don't reject Archie completely. That on some level, we care about him despite all of his ridiculousness and his bluster and his racism and his sexism and his homophobia and his anti-Semitism. And yet we can still care about him. And this is why I say we need this today, because we all have family members who we still love, or friends that we love, that in this polarized world that are really different. And if we watch Archie Bunker, we can go, oh, there is a way for me to totally disagree with what this person is saying or feel it's ridiculous and still think of them as a human, whether it's the liberal meathead or whether it's the racist Archie. And by the way, just talking about how big this show is, because we can't conceive of this. At the time, it had about 50 million people watching it every single week. Compared to the Game of Thrones finale, which is 19.3 million. That's the biggest thing that anybody has watched in terms of a dramatic or a theatrical thing, or not theatrical, but on TV like that since then. But that's not the kicker. The kicker is the size of the population, because the U.S. population during All in the Family was a little over 200 million. It was 330 million when the Game of Thrones finale happened. So the difference is that Game of Thrones finale, about 5.8% of Americans watched that.
Right.
The All in the Family was watched by a quarter, 25% of Americans. Yeah. Yeah. 25% of the entire population of the country was home watching that show. That's inconceivable today.
Yeah, today, well, because we also have so many channels and so many different types of content and YouTube and whatever, which of course we're currently on. That distracted, but it's an amazing number. No matter when you get that number, 50 million people, and for all our comments about maybe Rob not being the best actor on the show, he won 2 Emmy awards for his role on the show. He received 3 additional nominations, so he was nominated 5 times for Emmys, won twice, and he was nominated for 5 Golden Globes for his performances on that show. So that tells you the power of that show. That even in the actor who is probably the quote unquote the worst of the four, still was able to be nominated for a number of awards because he was able to find the real honest goofiness of the character, while the earnestness that was there in his political points of views or his philosophies of that character came through despite some of the missteps of his desires and intentions on that show as a character. And that speaks volumes to the performance that Rob Reiner did. But now we get into this area, Steve, where he's transitioning into directing. What can you say about this area?
Well, it's funny how he goes in there, because you kind of see the bits and pieces of how he gets there. So first of all, he has experience with sketch comedy, with the improv group in San Francisco, and that he's starting to make these connections. And something we talk about in our episode on When Harry Met Sally is he marries Penny Marshall, I think it's in 71, and they become the fabulous Hollywood comedy couple, and their parties are the greatest parties, and the people that are coming over to the parties are Billy Crystal and Robin Williams and Harry Shearer and Michael McKean and the other people, you know, the people who will become Spinal Tap. And he starts doing improv with these guys, and we could talk about the origin here, but in fact we are going to re-release our episode on Spinal Tap with our great guest Michael Ross. Some of the most fun episodes we've ever done. But I will say that, like, they come up with a completely unique way for him to start being a director. I think he had directed one TV movie before this, but it was this crazy Spinal Tap project that finally puts him on the map.
Yeah. And I think here's the thing that's crazy. During the the heyday of All in the Family, he writes a series called The Super in 1972. It only lasts one season, but he's already showing you that just acting is not the only thing he wants to do. He is actually, I've never heard that before, that someone is creating a series while they're already on another series. That's such an interesting thing. It only ran one season, and then eventually he does a TV movie, as you said, called More Than Friends, with his then wife, Penny Marshall. And it didn't quite work out as strongly. But I think this is all positive. And this is another lesson yet, if some of you who are listening or watching might take, is that, yeah, these things didn't work out for him. You know why? Because there was another destiny. And in the 80s, we start to see that destiny, as you said, with This is Spinal Tap. That's really where it starts to come in 1984. So it's a fascinating change and transition. And we've seen quite a few, obviously, Steve, quite a few actors become directors. Ben Affleck being one of the most famous ones recently, but then Greta Gerwig and what she's been able to do recently as well. So this is not something that's unusual necessarily, but to go and become even more successful after being an actor, Ron Howard did the same thing, right? Coming out of the Andy Griffith Show, Happy Days, becoming this really well-known director in the 80s and 90s and 2000s as well. It's an amazing thing what he's able to do at this time, moving into This is Spinal Tap.
Well, and I think, you know, the influence of watching his dad go from a performer and a writer to becoming a director and being on those sets while he's directing. Right. It's got to make, and you know, I mean, I totally, because I wanted to be an actor. I acted in plays from the time I was 6 years old until after graduating college. There was never a time that I wasn't, you know, at some point during the year acting in a play. But then I had this, I can remember it. It was in high school. I had seen a production of Zoo Story, a high school production of Zoo Story for the two best actors in the high school doing the parts. And I just had this moment of going like, oh, I can't do that. Like, I can't do what they're doing. Like, that's not the level of actor I am. But I remember like just going, but I do see why I think this would be better if this was downstage, or that they rushed that moment. And like, I started to, and I had a buddy who had written a play and I asked me to direct it. And it was just like, oh, I can act. I'm an okay actor.
Right.
This is actually where I belong, you know? Right. And I wonder if Rob was sort of discovering that. It's not that he stopped acting. Right. By the way, his next movie, The Sure Thing, if you're ready to move on.
Oh yeah. Yes, please. Yes.
This is my first Rob Reiner movie. Yeah. I didn't see Spinal Tap until several years later. I saw this, and this became, for my group of friends, this was the most quoted, most beloved movie. It's interesting because it is clearly a reaction. It's in this era of post Animal House, post Caddyshack, post Porky's, and you hear what the plot is. And the plot is a guy who hears there is a woman who is a sure thing, which means a sure thing to that she will have sex with you. And he is driving across the country to have sex with this beautiful woman. And so it sounds like, oh, it's like Porky's. We're off going to get laid. But it isn't. It's actually like When Harry Met Sally. It is classic romantic comedy. And this movie was one of the most quoted movies of all of my group of friends. We watched this over and over and over again.
Yeah, this is one that I just watched for the first time ever last week.
I want to hear. Oh, I have to hear. What'd you think?
I mean, it's a dated movie, right? And there are certain bits that I've seen done in other 80s films. I think if I had seen this in 1984, I think that's when it came out. Oh, 85, rather, when it came out, I think I'd have enjoyed the hell out of it because I love John Cusack and I love Daphne Zuniga, and I would have been just a lot more on board with it. But I think there are other films that did better what Rob was trying to do in this movie. Although I think we all have our guilty pleasures. We all have the films we love nostalgia wise. And so the fact that it's a big film for you all and quotable for your group of friends, I think is great because it's a fun film. It's absolutely a fun film, but it's out there. It's out there in some sequences. I mean, that boat sequence alone is an intense situation. And they turn it into a montage. I was kind of laughing all through that montage. So there are just certain things about that movie that I think are fun 1980s markers, right? But clearly this is him just kind of, you know how it is, Steve, you're kind of working it out. You're kind of figuring out as a director. This is Spinal Tap was something that he wrote. But the next two films, being The Sure Thing and Stand By Me, obviously he was not the writer because Stand By Me was Stephen King and someone else wrote The Sure Thing. I think it was, who was it here? Stephen L. Bloom and Jonathan Roberts. So he writes, this is Spinal Tap, directs that.
Then doesn't write, he does not write Spinal Tap.
Well,
Spinal Tap is improvised.
He's improvised. Sorry, he's credited as the writer of Spinal Tap, but fair, it is improvised. But like The Sure Thing and Stand By Me are two that he didn't write, but then he does everything until about 2005's Rumor Has It. Everything he does after Stand By Me is stuff that he writes. So I think Sure Thing is him kind of figuring it out after Spinal Tap. Stand By Me is an incredible leap forward. And then we really get into the meat of him as a director. And he goes on this incredible run of films.
I'm sure it wasn't on purpose, but I think it's so smart the way he approached it because Spinal Tap isn't like any other movie. We're improvising it. You don't have to have a script. So you don't have to do, because it's going to be improvised, you're not going to do it the way you would do a traditional film.
Right.
And they have a very low budget. So it's just like they're going to go shoot some stuff and improvise it. And the other advantage of doing it is that more than any other kind of movie, except the documentary, improvised film has to be created in the editing room. You're going to have 27 different versions of this scene and you're going to go, okay, well, what is this? What am I using? How am I going to cut this together? And the editing room is what teaches you how to be a director in so many ways because you learn what you need. And in particular, you learn how you fucked up and you don't have what you need in the editing room, which means that you're screwed. And that feeling of being screwed is the best teacher for the next film. And the next film is The Sure Thing. And I think you're totally right, is that A, it's fitting into a very specific 80s kind of sex teen comedy.
Yeah.
And so the stakes aren't that high. Like if you deliver enough of that humor and enough of what people want, then those teens in that era, that's not true anymore, are going to go see that film. They're going to rent it. They're going to watch it multiple times. And by the way, this is why we have John Cusack as a star. But you know, whether the movie is dated or not, it's a star-making performance for him. And I think you're absolutely right, is that he takes everything that he's learned on these somewhat low-stakes movies and somewhat odd movies, and now applies that to a movie that has real drama, it has a real pace, it's filmed in a really beautiful way. And Stand By Me, it's been really interesting because I like Stand By Me a lot, but I didn't expect, both on our Patreon and we've seen it on social media and I've seen it elsewhere, this is a truly beloved film for so many people.
Yeah, it's almost a coming of age, a rite of passage type it film is, for a lot of people. You know, it's amazing. And I do think it says something that Rob Reiner realized. I wonder if, and I'm going to guess on this, Steve, like Christopher Guest took this style of Spinal Tap and created a whole arm of comedy almost exclusively to himself till we got like Curb Your Enthusiasm and other things. But like, it was very much his lane that he was operating in. Rob Reiner had directed this Spinal Tap, and maybe he realized that that's not the comedy that I feel like doing anymore. It's not the place I belong anymore. Let me see what I can do with this. Let me challenge myself as a director and go next level with Stand By Me, or after Sure Thing, obviously the Sure Thing, but then Stand By Me. But then he goes right into Princess Bride. So to me, it's like he realized that comedy wasn't for him. He tries out this kind of teen comedy, sex comedy type of thing. That's maybe not 100% for him. And now he finds this kind of area here in the middle here, going with Stand By Me, adapting a Stephen King book and bringing out the beauty of this relationship of these four kids without sacrificing the stakes of what's going on here with these kids and some of the moments that are pretty unsettling to witness in a film like this and the danger that these kids get into with Kiefer Sutherland's gang, with the body, all of that stuff. But then the battles they have with each other. I think that's really what's an amazing part of the movie, is the conversations these kids are having that you don't think kids would normally have, yet you remember you probably had when you were a kid. And I think that's one of the reasons why so many of our fans who listen or watch us on the Cinephiles have been pushing us to do Stand By Me, because it is an important film for a lot of people at a certain age who have experienced the same things and feel seen, for lack of a better term, by this movie.
So I just watched Stand By Me again, maybe three nights ago.
Oh, wow.
And first of all, it's really great. Second of all, at least in my experience of watching it this time, I was like, you know what? I didn't have conversations like this. I think part of the magic of that movie is that they do get into the real stuff in the way that almost like you wish that you would. You wish you had a friend. And by the time I've been an adult, I've certainly had those conversations.
Right.
But not at that 12, 13 your age, you know.
Right.
There's
right.
so much, and I think part of it is it's leaving the normal world. It's that they it is a hero's journey in its own way. Yeah. You know, it follows that pattern of you have to leave town and you're going to learn things that you didn't expect and go up against challenges you didn't expect, and then you will return back home having been changed by the experience, and then you will be able to change the home. And that's totally what happens in Stand By Me. Yeah. It's really powerful. It's funny. The more I think about it, we said it about several of the directors we've done seasons of, is that there's some directors where, like, a Quentin Tarantino movie is a Quentin Tarantino movie.
Right.
It is what it is. Coen Brothers movies are Coen Brothers movies, but they will go from a light comedy to something really heavy and serious.
Yeah. Yeah.
And yet it maintains its Coen Brothers-ness. Whatever the Coen Brothers-ness is, you recognize something about it. And I think Rob Reiner is the same in a very different way. Like with the Coen Brothers, it's like, oh, we have these kooky characters. We're using these kinds of lenses. It has this kind of look, this kind of attention to detail, that's not what's going on with Rob Reiner. It's like he's applying his spirit to different genres.
Yeah.
Fully, you know, because Misery to Princess Bride to Stand By Me to When Harry Met. I mean, these are all really different genres. Yeah. And yet there's some feel to them that's quintessentially Rob Reiner. And I what I think it is, and this is just talking off the top of my head, but I think it's there's a humanity.
Yeah.
There's a real feeling of real humans going through whatever this is they're going through, you know?
You know, yeah, I think that's a great point you bring up, Steve. You know, having watched some of his interviews over the last month, having gotten a little more into him as a person and the things that he has done and the ways that he communicated with people about the things that he believed in, there are some directors who direct and you can tell that they hate humanity or they have an issue with human beings or they hate the people in power or, you know, whatever it is that they're profiling. There's like a judgment of this that they want to make sure people take away. Rob's films aren't like that. Rob's films, as you said, the humanity, but I think it's even farther. It's a love of human beings that comes through in his movies, right? And in even something like The Sure Thing, there is this care and love that he has for these characters and the things he wants to see these characters achieve or do and the conversations he wants these characters to have, right? And Stand By Me and how they're having their interactions. You go into The Princess Bride, there's a big heart in that movie, not the romance. It's the feeling everyone has, the love they have for each other as characters. And that's coming through in him as a director. When Harry Met Sally's the same way. Misery, to a degree, it's an interesting conversation to have about, does he love either of these characters? Is he seeking the audience to understand these characters, no matter how extreme Annie Wilkes is? Is that a thing? And then Few Good Men, even, there's this sense of like, there's something important here. These two kids are being railroaded by the system. And Demi Moore, in a way, I think, is Rob Reiner's voice in that movie, not Tom Cruise. Not Jack Nicholson, is Demi. Why? Because Demi's the one fighting for those two kids, those two Marines. And so I think there is a love he has for humanity, and he understands, but not without having rose-colored glasses about society and the things you go through. He's more about showcasing the fact that you can overcome, you can fight through it. There is a possibility for a happy ending. There is a better world you can create out there if you fight for it or if you endure the trials that you have to endure in order to get to them. And there are lessons to be learned because James Caan's character hates all his fans. He kind of hates that he's become this thing. And so he has to kind of find his way back to reappreciating the fact that he can actually have a career doing this. And so it's interesting when you look at these movies. I think he has a genuine love of humanity. And we know that as if you watch his interviews, that comes through with him as a person, you know? So it's no surprise that that's a massive element, as you said, the humanity, but the love for humanity that he has in his movies. Yeah.
I have a theory. I don't know if this theory is true, sure. But if you think about that the mood on the set affects the feel of the movie.
Mm-hmm.
So Kubrick, you know, brutalizes psychologically Shelley Duvall in The Shining, and that comes through in her performance. I had heard a rumor, I never confirmed it, but that I'd never found the evidence, so don't take this as a fact, but that just drew a blank on his name, director of Alien, is
Ridley Scott.
Thank you. My late 50s brain now just loses names all the time. So Ridley Scott, that he may or may not, they did night shoots when they didn't need to do night shoots because we're on a set. So generally you don't have to do night shoots unless you've gone over, but he wanted to do night shoots because he wanted people on edge. And the rumor I'd heard was that he had a starter pistol with blanks that he would fire randomly just to keep people on edge and freaked out. And then you know that when he shot the chest buster scene, that a lot of that was improvised because he kept that all from the actors so they would be genuinely disturbed when this happened. And can we say, if those things are true, some of them I know are true, some of them I don't know if they're true, but did that affect the reality and the feeling of the performances in the movie Alien? One might argue that they do. I think Rob Reiner's love is felt throughout all of his movies.
Yeah.
And there's the As You Wish, which is the book about the Princess Bride, which has the audiobook is great because Cary Elwes writes it and you have all of the characters saying their parts. And what every single person working on that movie expresses is how deeply they loved everyone they were working with, that it was an incredible, joyful experience. And I think that's part of what we're feeling. Is we're feeling the love that Rob has for the people he works with on the set every single day comes through in the film.
And I think the characters that he, the characters that these actors create, he loves these characters within his own films as well. And I think that's something that comes through when you're watching the movies as well. Because as an audience, you can't help but be caught up in falling in love with these characters because he presents them in such interesting ways and ways that just inspire us to love them. You know, even some of the foibles is we're kind of in the middle of when Harry met Sally, some of the not so savory elements of Harry at the beginning, they are set up so that you can understand that he's a guy who's got to do a little growing because of how life can kind of hit you in the face when you're not expecting it. So there's an arc he has to go on. And so I love that he's unafraid to show that in his characters. And the fact that he loves these characters and knows that they can be better, I think is a really positive thing. And even Tom Cruise in A Few Good Men, that's not a good guy initially. That's a guy who just sees everybody as kind of numbers and he's ambitious, trying to get to where he's going. But it takes this case, it takes these two young Marines and the things they're going through for him to snap out of it and really step up and do more. Play a hand, ante up, and it's there. And I love that about the characters in his movies, you know?
It'll be really interesting because obviously A Few Good Men is one of the Rob Reiner films we're going to do.
Yeah.
I have never seen the play. Obviously, it's based on an Aaron Sorkin play. And what I'm really curious about, it'll be interesting to learn, is how did it change when you went from the play to the movie? What things? And that's Rob Reiner coming in. That is a director coming in. And obviously, you change things in terms of locations. You change things to open it up. You know, you're not flying back and forth, you know, but. That in particular, because what you brought up about Demi Moore being the Rob Reiner character as opposed to Tom Cruise, I'm not going to spoil them, but I have a lot of thoughts about the Tom Cruise Demi Moore relationship, and I think you're on the money there. So it'll be real interesting to get to it.
Yeah, I can't wait till we talk about it. But yeah, I mean, let's talk about this run of movies, Steve. As we've been naming them already, but yeah, this is how it goes right after The Sure Thing. Right after This Is Spinal Tap, he goes into Stand By Me in 86, The Princess Bride in 87, When Harry Met Sally in 89, Misery in 90, A Few Good Men in 92. There's a bit of a stumble with North in 94, but he picks it back up again in The American President in 95. And after you get past 95, I think it's kind of a mixed bag of films. Yeah, but like that's a hell of a run from, let's say, 84 to 95. 11 years, you would argue 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, 10, 11 films there. Maybe two. One is probably Bad North. The Sure Thing is a guilty pleasure. And then the other ones are pretty damn good. That's a hell of a run to have to start your career. And whatever Carl Reiner's issues were with his son, Carl Reiner never had a run like this as a director of films. And it's an incredible statement of the kind of versatility, intelligence, and artistic ability that Rob Reiner had to bring to life in such great ways these different type of genres of movies and be successful. I've said this before. He's like the Billy Wilder of our age or our generation, and he's incredible at it.
You know, when you said Billy, my brain immediately went to Billy Joel, and we talked about the great Billy Joel documentary and how he was a popular musician that people loved his songs but never got the critical respect.
And that
these are totally beloved songs. Because the thing about Rob Reiner films, which you cannot say about a Scorsese films, which you cannot say, I think, about Kubrick, is that my guess is you name Stand By Me, Princess Bride, When Harry Met Sally. These are beloved movies.
Yeah.
These are movies that, like, it's like I said at the beginning, these are the part of people's families. You know, A Clockwork Orange is a powerful film.
Yes.
But you don't feel about A Clockwork Orange the way you feel about The Princess Bride or When Harry Met Sally.
Right,
like, they're different. And so, this run is incredible that he could, you know, lodge so many rooms in my heart, essentially, one after another as he made these movies.
And only one of them was ever nominated for Best Picture. Only one of his films was ever nominated for Best Picture, and that was A Few Good Men. And I would argue Princess Bride deserves to be nominated for Best Picture. You know, I could argue When Harry Met Sally deserves to be nominated for Best Picture, but they were not. Only a few good men.
What's crazy, we'll talk about when we get to When Harry Met Sally, but I looked at what the nominations were. Of course, this is 89. This is the year of Driving Miss Daisy beating Do the Right Thing, which was not nominated. And that's always been the huge controversy, as it should be. Do the Right Thing, one of the most groundbreaking, important films in the history of America. And that probably would be my pick for Best Picture. But When Harry Met Sally, 100% is a better movie than Driving Miss Daisy.
I agree.
It easily could have been Best Picture that year, in my opinion.
Yeah, 100%. Well, Steve, let's go. What do you want to say about these movies? I mean, because we could spend another 3 hours talking about these movies, but this is only supposed to be like an hour and a half, 2 hour show. So what do you want to say about this run? What do you want to hit on? What do you want to specify? What do you want to make sure we discuss as we're talking about the life of Rob Reiner and the career of Rob Reiner?
Like I said, we're re-releasing Spinal Tap, Princess Bride, Misery, and wait, is there? No, that's all of them that we're re-releasing.
Yes.
So let me ask you this. It's been many years, probably, I think it's 8 years since we did The Princess Bride. Do you have you watched it since then? And what are your feelings about it today?
I have watched it at least 5 or 6 times since we did it. Yeah, I mean, it's just... Anytime I stumble upon that movie, I go back to being a teenager sitting at the AMC in Dale City, Virginia, in the aisle seat of a stadium seating arena. And I remember the walkway is between the two. It separated the two. It walked down the middle. You separated the two sides. And I just remember sitting there, and I will never forget that experience because I had never seen a film that magical. And I'd never seen a film as a romantic young teenager that kind of spoke to me in that way about the romantic nature of love, but also having Andre the Giant in it as me being a WWF kid who grew up with the WWF in the late, in the early 80s, seeing Billy Crystal, as I've said, one of my favorite comedic performers ever. I had no idea who Robin Wright was. I had no idea who Cary Elwes was. I didn't know who Mandy Patinkin was. And so all of this was an exposure to me. And every time I watch the film, it's such a joy. There's such love in that movie that I think is incredible. And the performance of Christopher Guest, Chris Sarandon, just all of it, the magical characters. And again, the message at the end, right? It's like, and they go through stuff. Like Wesley, they think Wesley died and he's come back as the Dread Pirate Roberts. He thought she left him for the prince. So there is this conflict and struggle that is real, that is at times pretty harsh in their exchanges with each other, that the film doesn't shy away from. And of course, this is based on William Goldman's book. So, but like, I think he does an incredible job with that movie. And I still love that movie to pieces. And every time I see it again, I regress to being like a 14-year-old, 15-year-old in the theater smiling at the film and feeling loved by the movie. Is that something I can say? I feel that the film loves me. And that is something really comforting, man.
We're circling around the same thing. That's, you know, that there's this feeling, and it's, I feel the same way watching When Harry Met Sally. I feel the same way watching Stand By Me. I feel embraced by the movie on some level.
100%. Like,
that's the magic of it. It's funny. So The Princess Bride, same reaction. I saw it. I think it was at the UA Theater on Shattuck. People can listen to our what we say when maybe we match what we said 7 or 8 years ago.
Yeah, maybe.
When we recorded it, hopefully. Yeah. But like, I don't think I had ever seen a movie that saw me more than The Princess Bride. And particularly because like I was in college. I think I'm a freshman or sophomore. And so I'm not that much older than Fred Savage. You know, I'm close enough then that I can remember being homesick from school and playing video games. And of course, I was a kid who was always reading fantasy books. I was reading Piers Anthony. I was reading Tolkien. Oh, yeah. I was reading all that stuff. And so like, this was my world. Yeah. And the thing that's amazing about The Princess Bride that I don't know any other movie that hits this level in this delicate way.
Yeah.
Which is that it is a satire. It has this modern language. It is making fun of fantasy stories.
Yeah.
And it is 100% delivering on the fantasy story.
Yeah.
It manages to be wry and sarcastic about it and still completely give you the great sword fight, the great love scene, the great adventure. And those characters are it is funny is that they take, again, it is archetypal characters, the man in black, the giant, the swordsman, the evil prince. And yet he makes them not just archetypes. They become really, really real people that you love.
Yeah. And I think it's something you bring up really well. You just brought up a few seconds ago. The fantasy is never sacrificed for the topical evergreen reality of the movie. The interactions are very modern interactions. Vesic tear his arm off. Oh, this key. You know, there's these little moments that you're like, this is very modern comedy. This is very modern comedy that you're watching, even though it's set in a fantastical time that we imagine is sometime in the past, because they're kings and queens and the look of the structure and all of that. It makes it feel like it's at some other time, but the interactions are very modern. And I appreciate, and I think it's amazing the way he walks that line. I mean, when Carol Kane comes in, I'm not a liar, I'm your wife. Like, that is, you know, that is, what is that doing in a fantasy? But it works so well, you know, and I can't imagine, and I imagine there are people who are hardcore Dungeons and Dragons people who loved Princess Bride because, you know, when you're leading a campaign from the limited amount of exposure I've had with Dungeons and Dragons, you're having like these regular interactions that you would have, even though you're set in some fantastical world that you're imagining your characters to be in. So I think it was able to capture that really well in that movie as well. Yeah, for sure.
I have a memory of being in the theater and having a moment. There's a moment in the film that just, you know, when you're 100% sold, when you just laugh out loud and you're like, oh my God, I love this movie so much. It's not a big moment, but it's the moment where the prince is talking to Count Rugen. They've just put Wesley in the pit of despair. He's asking him to come down and watch. And he goes, I wish I could, Tyrone, but I have a wedding to plan, my wife to murder, and Gilder to frame for it. I'm swamped. And he says, get some rest. If you haven't got your health, you haven't got anything. And at that moment, I don't know why it was that line, because it's so out of time. It is such a line of a modern line. And we're also kind of like, what is the relationship between these two guys? And I just burst out laughing. And I was at that moment, I'm like, I will love this movie forever. No other movie does for me what The Princess Bride does.
Yeah. Yeah. And I highly recommend for anybody who's listening or watching us to pick up the Criterion version that I think is now out in 4K.
Yep.
There's a lot of really great special features on there for people to watch. I highly, if you love the movie, it's a must own for God's sake. All right. What else do you want to say about these movies, Steve, or any of the movies afterwards? Yeah, go ahead.
Well, we're obviously talking a lot about When Harry Met Sally. And so in a week, you can hear part one of what will certainly be a multi-part exploration of this film. And just a spoiler alert, I love this movie so much. Like, I'm very excited to talk about it. So, but the next one after that is Misery next, I believe.
Yeah,
Misery. Misery is his next film. So we did that, I think, 3 or 4 years ago.
Yeah.
My feelings about Misery is it's the craftsmanship. It's every single shot, the storytelling, and in particular, taking this unbelievably intense physical actor and sticking him in a bed and saying, I'm going to tell this whole story with this guy who can barely move. That is as uncinematic a thing as you can possibly have. And Reiner makes it incredibly cinematic. This is where you see the craftsmanship and chops of the director. Not showy, but boy, he knows how to tell a story.
And, you know, if he wanted to do horror films, he could have probably had a very successful career making horror films, because there's a lot of shots in that movie that are very horror, classic horror shots, especially when he's framing Kathy Bates as Annie Wilkes in this thing. Of course, she won the Oscar for this role.
Yeah.
There is something amazing about what he's able to do in showing some of the horror. He even has some homages to Psycho in the movie in terms of the shots, the overhead shots and what have you. So there's so much about what he does in that movie that is incredible. And I think this is him maturing as a filmmaker, right? Like, yes, Stand By Me, Princess Bride, When Harry Met Sally. These are fun films that you can get lost in and enjoy the characters and enjoy what's going on, the fantastical stuff of it, you know, and the kid stuff of it. But now moving into, after When Harry Met Sally, moving into Misery, he's an older guy now in 1990. Yeah. So there's something more he wants to, now he's been, you know, he's been exposed to fandom. He goes back to Stephen King, who was one of the, who was the, you know, writer of Stand By Me. So there's a transition place for him here in 90. And then we get A Few Good Men, the American President, Ghosts of Mississippi. These are much more mature movies that have much less comedy in them, and they're much more about stuff. Story of Us, in essence, could be a connection to When Harry Met Sally. Then you've got the romantic comedy of Alex and Emma, Rumor Has It, a really poignant movie in the bucket list. If you guys haven't seen that one with Morgan Freeman and Jack Nicholson about cancer. And then we've got stuff like LBJ. And then we finish up, of course, with his last film, Spinal Tap 2, that dropped last year, which it didn't get the greatest reviews. Wasn't the best movie. But
Did you watch it?
I've watched about 30 minutes of it, and it just breaks my heart to watch because it's not that great. So it's like it's like Bill and Ted 3. I was like, oh, this is. I know people think it's good.
I think you had to. I did watch it. I watched it shortly before he died, actually.
Oh.
And it's I think it's one of those movies where you have to put yourself into a certain space. If you could put yourself into it, because part of it is it's really them just hanging out in the studio a lot. You know, and Paul McCartney shows up and Elton John shows up. And if you like hanging out with these guys, you know, it's funny. We just did this is terribly disrespectful, but I'm going to say it anyway. Okay. We just did a short on Second Screens.
Oh, yeah.
And it's a good second screen movie. Is that you get to listen to them, and when they have and you get to listen to them sing and listen to their music, and when they have a funny joke, you're totally there for it.
Yeah,
but
yeah,
it's not that much that you're gonna miss.
But we'd be remiss to not talk about him as an actor as well through the night. So he's making all these movies, but he's also performing in films. Like he was in Postcards from the Edge, he is in Sleepless in Seattle, he's in Bullets Over Broadway. He's in the First Wives Club. He's in Primary Colors, which I personally still love that movie.
I like
the story
it a lot.
He puts himself in The Story of Us. Ed TV, The Majestic. He's in Wolf of Wall Street, as I talked about earlier. Shock and Awe. And then puts himself, of course, back in Spinal Tap 2 as Marty DeBerge. So kept working consistently in films as well as making films. So not even acting in, and he acted in the films he was in small parts, but he was also acting bigger roles in other films. So a guy who was constantly working, constantly doing stuff, constantly creating. It's an amazing thing, Steve, what he was driven to accomplish and do and make and create here out in the world.
It's funny. Justin Toner just posted that he loves him in Wolf of Wall Street as DiCaprio's dad.
Yeah,
totally agree. I think that is inspired casting because what's a lot of casting is allowing someone to be who they are in a circumstance that they would never be in. Like that character that he plays sounds a lot like Rob Reiner.
Yeah.
Except for the things that he has to talk about in that movie, which I mean, it is so, I mean, it's one of the funniest parts of the movie is Scorsese's choice to cast Reiner in that part.
I have to believe, as you said, that Scorsese loves Rob Reiner's films.
They're buddies.
They're friends. He was perfect for this role. And that scene where he comes in to yell at them about the appetizer and how much money they spent on the appetizers and where they were really spending it on this other stuff. It's an incredible scene. Just like the scene with him and Jon Favreau trying to convince DiCaprio at his house to accept the deal, Jordan Belfort to accept the deal. There's like this kind of thing where he is so comedic. And I have to believe that he was excited to kind of scratch that itch again and do a little fun comedy beats within the film that's got something to say. But I will say when Jordan is being led away after he gets convicted, Rob Reiner does a great job dramatically in his face of being a father who is disappointed and sad for his son and also frustrated at the situation. I thought that was some really nice acting from him as well. So, you know, I will say the one negative about his life is that I wish he had done more acting. I wish he had found a way to roles that kind of brought out more of some of the more challenging things that he must have gone through in life. And especially when you hear about what happened with his son and all, I mean, I think there was a great performance that was still there that was left on the table by Rob Reiner. And I wish a director and a script had come along that would have really showcased why Rob Reiner is such a fantastic actor, and we could have appreciated him in a whole new way, added another tool in that toolbox from him as a performer. I wish we had seen that. You know,
it's funny thinking that someone has a certain time frame. You know, like Rob Reiner made a certain set of movies during that is unmatched anywhere, in my opinion. And then he made other movies that are fine, you know.
Yes.
And that's, you know, they're very, very few directors that have more than a short run of films or are inconsistent. But I also think it's important to point out that both him as a producer and then his company Castle Rock also is super important. Some, you know, one of the ones, of course, is that it's Castle Rock that was the company behind Seinfeld.
Yeah.
So Seinfeld, one of the most transformative shows ever on television. They also produced Roseanne, which you mentioned before, Murphy Brown, My So-Called Life was also produced by Castle Rock. They also produced, in addition to all the Rob Reiner films, they produced The Shawshank Redemption and The Green Mile.
Yeah.
You know, these are important films.
Yeah. And I think that's, again, there's this instinct of understanding what the people want, right? And there's this desire to put that out there. And you can see that with Castle Rock and the various types of projects that were put out and sponsored and fought for. Because after the first season of Seinfeld, I think a lot of people already heard this story, but for those of you who haven't, it was not doing well, the ratings. No. And it was Rob Reiner who went into NBC and said, give this thing one more season. I guarantee you it'll be great. Give it one more season, and convince them to keep Seinfeld on the air. And even Jerry says this all the time. Like, he is the one who saved Seinfeld. We would never have Seinfeld if it hadn't been for Rob Reiner fighting for Seinfeld. And yes, of course, maybe ulterior motives, because his company who produced it. But I also think he clearly was right, because this became one of the greatest comedies ever. I don't think it's the greatest comedy, but it's certainly one of the greatest situation comedies ever, you know? You know, Steve, what is fascinating too is when you look at it, is that there are a lot of projects he didn't do that he was up for. And I think this is a fascinating thing, a list, and I'd love to hear what you think about some of these. In the 1990s, he was going to do an Angela Davis biopic with Lynn Whitfield. And Angela Davis was a very powerful, outspoken Black woman from the 1970s who fought for the rights of Black people there at that time. He was going to do a version of Into the Woods in the 1990s.
One of your favorites.
Yes. He even had a read through with Robin Williams, Cher, Steve Martin, Goldie Hawn, and Danny DeVito in various parts. He was going to write it with Lowell Gansing, Babalu Mandel. So that would have been interesting to see that. He was going to do in the 2010s. He had a global war thing that he was going to do on Morris TV. This was something he was going to explore, this book that had been written, and see what he could do with that. He was going to do Shawshank Redemption as well. He had been offered it as an alternative director to Frank Darabont if he didn't take it. And he was even offered to direct the first Harry Potter movie before Christopher Columbus took it. I think, I got to be honest with you, I have a feeling the first two films would be even more revered, because I don't think they're that great, but I know there are a lot of people who love those first two films. Rob Reiner directing the Harry Potter movies, I think, would have been amazing. Nothing against Chris Columbus. I just think it would have been amazing. You know,
I think there's a real linkage between the Princess Bride and the Harry Potter books.
Yes.
And
yes.
William Goldman. And it's so funny, you know, whatever people think about J.K. Rowling at this moment, those books have this same mix of humor and magic, like doing the real fantasy and make it enjoyable, but also having a little bit of, like, I always think of it as kind of a Douglas Adams sort of remove that allows you to have that comedy and sense of humor. And I think that is very consistent with The Princess Bride. And so had he done it, I think he would have brought it. I mean, like, I don't know that Rob, he never really did a really design effects heavy kind of show.
Yeah.
I mean, The Princess Bride is not effects heavy. It's not design heavy. You know, it's relatively simple. Whereas Harry Potter, you would have had to do a bunch of that stuff. I mean, it's so funny. Like, I think I cannot argue with the success of those first two Harry Potter movies. They did exactly what they needed to do. It's not that I even find tons of fault with them. I think they're just a little bit empty. You know,
I agree with that. I think they're a little empty. They're not as magical as you hope they would be. But I know there are people who disagree with this, Steve, who love those first two movies. So, you know, it is what it is. What do you want to say about his later films? Are there any of these that stand out for you in terms of maybe better than people think, or not necessarily?
Yes.
Go ahead. We've got Ghost of Mississippi.
Most of them, you know, Ghost of Mississippi, I think, is okay. North. I can remember going to see it in the movie theater and being so excited to go see it, and then going, Oh, because it had been this amazing run. You know, he'd had this incredible run. And I think I've seen rumor has it and kind of wish that I hadn't, you know, like there are a couple other movies like that. But the one movie, which I just watched again, as I said, that documentary on Albert Brooks is fantastic.
I agree. I think The Bucket List, if people haven't seen it.
And The Bucket List. Absolutely.
Yeah. I was really surprised at that one. And I didn't expect to be. I think LBJ didn't quite get there being Charlie. And So It Goes is fine. Not the greatest, but it's fine. Magic of Belle Isle. I think there are some people who like Magic of Belle Isle.
I haven't seen that one either.
Yeah. And I do think The Story of Us is actually, I think that's worth a revisit. Bruce Willis and Michelle Pfeiffer delivering an interesting exploration of relationships, mature exploration of relationships as it's a marriage is kind of falling apart for a number of reasons. So I kind of enjoy that for what it's not a great film, but I think it's certainly a watchable film in what it's exploring. But we haven't mentioned much about The American President, Steve. We should maybe finish up our film conversation by talking about that film. What are your thoughts on The American President?
Well, it's so weird. I mean, The American President has a strange asterisk next to it in my brain because it's the proto West Wing.
Yeah, and true. 100%.
And the West Wing, you know, like my two favorite TV shows of all time are probably Star Trek, the original series, and The West Wing. I adore The West Wing. And so when I saw The American President before The West Wing existed, I absolutely loved it. And it's a fan. I think it is has all of those Capra-esque elements, which are mentioned in the movie. I think it does a great job of a very dated mid-90s version of how hardcore politics works. You know, I think Annette Bening and Michael Douglas are fantastic. It is so funny to watch Martin Sheen play the Leo part up against Michael Douglas playing the president. That's what makes it all so weird. But you have all that Aaron Sorkin dialogue. Michael J. Fox plays a great sort of young guy in the scene, and Richard Dreyfuss is the conservative bad guy is perfect. So I think it's really, really good. I think it pales in comparison to The West Wing, which is so much of a bigger thing. But I totally like The American President. I haven't rewatched it. It's one I should probably rewatch, and I will in the next couple of days. Maybe we'll even do a short on it. I'd love to.
Oh yeah, yeah. Why not? That would be a lot of fun for sure. We'd be remiss not to mention, you know, we're not going to get into specificity, but or choosing sides or whatever. But, you know, along with doing all the things that he was doing, he was also in very hardcore into politics and being a liberal activist. He was the co-founder of the American Foundation for Equal Rights, which challenged California Proposition 8 that bans same-sex marriage in the state. So we wanted to overturn it, and he ended up winning in that. He chartered the campaign to pass the California Proposition 10 Act, which is California Children and Families Initiative, which is a program of early childhood development services funded by a tax on tobacco products. He was the chairman of that organization for 7 years there. And it led to his likeness being used satirically in the South Park episode, Butt Out, where he was depicted as a tyrant there. And so there was a number of things that he was involved in throughout. So he was a person who definitely felt that he had more to give beyond the creative side of things and had no problem being politically active. But I also think if you watch his stuff, he wasn't someone who's trying to destroy the other side or vilify the other side. He was a guy who was open to having these conversations as long as they were honest conversations about the issues. He went on conservative shows. He went on liberal shows. He went on middle of the road shows to talk about these things, and he had no problem doing so. He's very gregarious, he's very easy to listen to, and he's very intelligent in how he was delivering his points of views. And even when he contradicted or had a different point of view than the other person, it was never about taking down the other person. It was about trying to, you know, get them to understand the point of view they were coming from while also honoring their point of view. And so I think that's another thing that is a sad loss from his passing, is that I think we need more voices of people who are open to hearing through honest discourse about these kinds of things, because there's a lot of dishonest discourse on both sides, and we need more honest discourse to seek compromise. And I think he always seemed to seek compromise in the conversations he had with people, and I appreciated that about him as a person. And I think these films endure not because they choose sides. They endure because they're universal. His films endure that no matter what your political bent is, there is something for you to connect to in the characters of his great films, which is why they endure so much and they cross all political lines. And people from all sides of the political aisle spoke about the loss of Rob Reiner and the tragic nature with which he passed, you know, excusing one particular person or not mentioning one particular person, but pretty much everybody across the board spoke of the pain of the loss of Rob Reiner because of the love they had for his films. And that's an amazing thing.
I'm not sure what person you're referring to. I can't think of anyone off the top of my head, but the it's funny. I will say there were times, I mean, you know, Rob Reiner, in addition to apparently looking like me, shares some, you know, I share politics with him. There were times where I felt he got a little shrill in some of his attacks on people. And it's funny, there's the South Park where he gets, I forget what they called him, but they did a Rob Reiner style character and made fun of him. But the thing about it for me is, I mean, the reality is you and your politics might very well disagree with it. You might have hated him for political reasons.
Sure.
But in my opinion, from what I have read, it is very possible that gay marriage would not be legal in the United States without Rob Reiner.
Yeah.
I mean, that is the scale. And so, and I am unapologetically 100% for the rights of people that love each other to get married.
Yeah.
And so if that's not your politics, you disagree with that, that's fine. But I am giving him all of the rewards that he deserves and honor him for doing just that one thing. And also campaigning for preschool and childcare in California and things like that. I mean, there was a moment where people were talking about him running against the governor to run against Arnold for the governor of California, which would have been hilarious had he had done it. But like, this was a guy who, in my opinion, his heart was very much in the right place. Yeah. And what he, and when he acted, when he worked with, in terms of film, he worked out of love. That's what we've been talking about this whole time. And when he worked politically, he was driven by love. He wasn't driven by hate. And yes, sometimes he had some angry rants. And yes, your politics might be different from his. But that's, but if you, and this is maybe, this is why I want to go back to things like All in the Family, where you can do a show where there's all of the horrible things that people say sometimes, and yet still instill it with a sense of love, which is what he gave even to Kathy Bates's character in Misery.
Yeah,
is that he loves that character on some level, even though she's a scary, scary person. And that's, you know, that's what he contributed to us. That's what I keep coming back to, is just this word love.
Yeah, I agree. I think that sounds like a perfect way to encapsulate him as a person. When you're watching his work, there's a lot of love in his work. There's a lot of love that we feel. And as we kind of discovered in our conversation, we feel, I think a lot of people who are listening to us or watching us feel that, embraced by his movies, seen by his movies, loved by his movies. And they touch us in that way, which is why his loss is felt so deeply by people like us and others around who are listening or watching us now, for sure. Any final words? As we're at an hour and a half, Steve, we should wrap up this conversation. Any final words do you want to say?
No, I know we had gotten a couple of questions.
Yeah, we do. We're going to get to those. Yeah. You want to get to those first? Okay, let's get to those first.
Sorry.
Yeah, no problem. No problem at all. Wiley OFC says, sorry I'm late, but watch Story of Us for the first time. The soundtrack by Eric Clapton is so good. I miss Rob deeply every day. Yeah. If there's one film I encourage people to see from the latter half of his movies, it is the Story of Us. Absolutely. Give it a shot. It's good. Visa Wada 316 says $26,000 worth of sides. Do they cure cancer? I don't know what
I don't mean. Know. This is a mystery message. I think that, but I'd like whatever 26,000, I'd like to cure cancer. Curing cancer sounds good. I am in favor of curing cancer.
I am as well, considering I lost my father to cancer. I don't want people to lose their parents to cancer. No. Let's cure it. All right, Steve, let's wrap it up. What final words would you like to say? And what would you like to tease about what we got coming up here on the Cinephiles in our season of Rob Reiner?
So I'm going to repeat my final words before, which is that the big thing that I feel from him and his greatest movies is the love. It is the love behind the scenes, the love for the characters in the film, the love and craftsmanship for the storytelling. And he does movies that are about the humanity of the people in them, even when those people are going through some tough things. So that, you know, I'm always going to be a fan of Rob Reiner and of his films. As far as what we've got going on, we're right in the middle. We've recorded half of part one of When Harry Met Sally. That's going to be at least a two-parter, maybe three. Then yeah. we're moving on. I believe the next one we're doing is A Few Good Men.
Yep.
And so excited about that. And then this was, we thought we were just going to do two movies. And then we got so many people saying, you guys are going to do Stand By Me, right? You're going to do Stand By Me. And we had a great conversation with our advisory board a few days ago. And yes, we are doing three Rob Reiner films. So we are doing When Harry Met Sally, A Few Good Men, and Stand By Me. So that's going to be a very long season of Rob Reiner. And it's not our only season of a director for the year. Right. John, do you want to tell who the other director we're going to be covering?
Yeah, well, I mean, a very big movie is coming out that's at the top of the list of a lot of people's most anticipated films of 2026. And that is The Odyssey. So we will be doing a season of Christopher Nolan to line up with the timing of the release of The Odyssey. So we're going to talk about him. We're going to explore a couple of films of his as well, which I think Oppenheimer is one of them. And we're kind of deciding what our second one is going to be. So we are breaking our 10-year rule to dive into Oppenheimer, which I personally cannot wait to do on our show. And we'll let you all know what our second film is going to be. So that will be our other season. So we'll do Rob Reiner, take a break from Rob Reiner, do some other movies, and then jump into our season of Christopher Nolan. So look for that later on this year.
That's some big, big, serious stuff on coming to the Cinephiles. And listen, because we haven't officially locked down, we have a couple of movies in contention. If you have suggestions for what you want that other Nolan film to be, bear in mind that we have already done Dark Knight and we've already done Inception, which will be re-releasing during that time. So then the question is, what are the other ones going to be? Right. We'll see.
We'll see. We'll see for sure. And just to clarify, Vince Zawada was saying that this is the line from Wolf of Wall Street that Rob Reiner says, $26,000 worth of sides? Do they cure cancer? Yeah, it's a very...
It totally makes sense now. I didn't understand it before.
Thank you, Vincent. I appreciate you clarifying that for us because we didn't get it. So, all right. Well, yeah, I think Steve summed it up. Love. That's what we're talking about with Rob Reiner. That's what we all feel. I think everyone listening or watching us feels that way about his movies as well and about the man. And it is a deep loss, but you know, the thing you understand as you get older is you're going to lose people. People are going to leave you along the way. So after grieving their loss, the next step is to appreciate we even had them. And the fact that we even had a Rob Reiner in our world, I think is amazing because so many of us were moved and touched and probably changed by seeing Rob Reiner's movies. At formative ages, no matter what age you are, you can discover these films again and again. You can go all the way back and remember the messages. And maybe these are great films that people need to go back to more to remember the messages of love within his films that I think are very important and still resonate with so many of us today and are still resonating with new generations of film fans who discover his movies all over again. And so... to his family, to his friends, to everybody who has loved Rob Reiner, we send, of course, our deepest condolences still a month later and our warmest thoughts and the thoughts of strength to help them through this very, very tough time because it is obviously a complicated situation with his son involved. But we also wanted to give our love and respect to his work here as we start this season of Rob Reiner. All right. So for my... partner Steve Moore, is that correct? Oh, and if you want, is there one more thing we need to say, Steve? If you want to subscribe, what do you want to say there? Yes.
Well, sorry. We can't. Yes, you can. Yeah, I am your partner, Steve Morris. Look, sometimes it's a live show. It's live television, people. Things go the way they go. You can subscribe to the Cinephiles at all the usual places, including right here on YouTube. Make sure to click the like button and subscribe here. You can go to patreon.com/thecinephiles to support the show, see ad-free versions, listen to our Cinephile shorts, and of course, join our advisory board. The ad-free shows and the shorts are also available on Apple Podcasts. You can buy or stream every movie we've ever reviewed on cinephiles.net, except that whoever runs that website has a couple of movies to update it. They're a little bit behind. I'm not going to say who that is, but it's me. So I got to catch up before you can buy When Harry Met Sally, but that's coming soon. And if you want to reach me, it's SR Morris on Twitter, SR Morris 1 on Instagram.
And you can reach me at The Roca Says on all the social medias. And if you want to subscribe to my YouTube channel, after you subscribe to this YouTube channel, please make sure you and leave your comments down below. you can head over to my channel, youtube.com/JohnRocaSays, for all the stuff I got going over there as well. All right. Look forward to our part one of When Harry Met Sally coming next week. And we look forward to hearing from you all about what Nolan film you want us to do down the road later on this year in our season of Nolan. And we'll talk to you next time with another brand new episode here of The Cinephiles. Take care and peace. Until then.